CROM Vault Podcast, episode number 317, Tuesday, November 13th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. KMO here, and have a conversation that I've actually been sitting on for a while, at least, you know, for me. Some podcasters record a lot more material than they actually use, and sometimes they end up sitting on good interviews that they plan to use for months, just waiting for an opening in their production schedule, you know, to use a particular interview. I'm exactly the opposite. I'm usually recording and publishing either on the same day or within a few days with no backlog whatsoever. And that is largely in service to my lack of organizational skills, because a file that's been sitting on my computer unused for more than a few days is basically sliding into the abyss. I don't have a particularly systematic file naming regimen, which I understand is a downfall or at least a weakness of a lot of creative types. Please, please bring on the AI. You know, at least in the service of people doing things like I do. And bringing on the AI is very much the topic of the conversation with Rob. We're going to be talking about a book that he has read and I have not. The book is called Automating Inequality, although I did hear an interview with the author on NPR. NPR, which pisses me off to no end, but at the same time, I've been listening for decades and I'm not about to stop because, you know, they are the mainstream perspective pitched at people with long attention spans and a bit more appetite for detail and nuance than what you get on television. Now, if you're interested, you know, in any particular topic, you're going to get a much deeper coverage in podcast form. You know, there are bazillions of podcasts now, and there is somebody who is very informed on the topic of interest to you who is doing a podcast or at least has been interviewed by somebody who does a podcast in that general topic area. Which, of course, you well know. When was the last time you heard a report in the corporate news media about any of the topics that I cover here in the C-Realm and the C-Realm Vault that was remotely adequate to the topic? Anyway, in the conversation with Rob, the most recent mass shooting, the one in California at the Country Western Bar, had yet to occur. So I think we make reference to the previous mass shooting, which was in Pittsburgh. Maybe we didn't. I don't know. I will admit, in our environment, in our country where acts of gun violence get picked up and echoed endlessly in the corporate media, it does seem like these acts of mass public violence happen pretty regularly. Do they happen more regularly now than they did two decades ago? I suspect yes, but not so much more often that it really moves the needle if you're looking at the phenomenon from a statistical point of view. These are still outlier events, very rare, and very low on the list of things that you should actually be worrying about, you know, if you're thinking in Bayesian terms. But if you're thinking in narratives, it's a powerful narrative. And thinking in narratives is what we do. It's what comes naturally to us. And thinking in terms of probabilities does not come naturally. We have to make a deliberate effort to do so. So I have not yet listened to the recording that I am about to play for you. It's as if we are going to be listening to the podcast together because I have no comments for the end. Usually I would record the intro and outro basically in one take, knowing exactly, or pretty much anyway, what's in the middle of the sandwich. It's been so long since I recorded this interview, like a week maybe, that I don't have a very clear memory of what's in it. So I'm going to listen right now, take some notes, and then I'll be back at the end to wrap up. So here we go. All right, it is election day, 2018, November, what is it, 6th?
6th.
You voted? I voted?
Yes.
I'm here with Rob. And in a minute, we're going to talk about Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor by Virginia Eubanks.
Yes. A very interesting book. Virginia Eubanks is a professor of political science, so this, if I met her, I wouldn't think that she would write this kind of a book because she's a political scientist. But there's some poli-sci in this, but most of it's social services and data and stuff. So it's kind of interesting that she chose it. Anyway, so she, the book is set out in basically three parts or three case studies of how some states and then in one case a county automated their in one case automated the welfare benefits system. That's in Indiana back in 2007. And then another case is Los Angeles, which is over the past 10 years also, they've created a huge data warehouse around all of the homeless people in the city of Los Angeles.
I was just in Los Angeles and I didn't tour it on foot, but I drove through what's called Skid Row, which is an area that's larger than you would imagine. It goes on for many blocks.
Yeah. And they talk about Skid Row in the book here, because that's a center of the housing issue, at least in that city. And then the third case is the Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, how they automated their child protection services and what impacts that has. So the basic gist is she's looking at these automations of what used to be social services, where you would go see a case manager or you would meet with someone sort of locally and they would determine if you got benefits or if your child needed to be taken away or if they could help you get some housing, right? Well, now it's all data-driven. You're using big data warehouses and algorithms. Algorithm, for people who don't know what that is kind of like an if-then statement, but it's a long one, really long one. So you and I could say that here on a piece of paper and make the same decision-making process, but the computer can do it in milliseconds.
Right.
But you still have an algorithm that has been designed by humans, and that means you make up what the if-then is. So you can say, okay, if I'm 53 years old and white and I drive a Honda Civic, then my insurance rate is going to be different than the 21-year-old driving a Chevy Camaro with a DUI on his record, right? So it's like kind
and
of
that's that's a legitimate distinction to make.
It is. I'm not saying that's bad, but that's what it is. But you can also discriminate in that algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
You can come in with preconceived notions about the people are who will be running the people whose data will be run through the algorithm and what they deserve and what they don't deserve. And it looks like, at least in the case of Indiana, that looks like what it was done. So,
I heard an NPR interview with her, and they started off with a case of a woman who she got a notice saying that she had to requalify for her medical benefits, and she had an appointment with somebody that she had to keep on a certain day, and she contacted that office and said, look, I'm in the hospital being treated for ovarian cancer. I can't make it. And that message, I mean, it was like talking to a wall. I mean, it was all automated. And so her benefits were denied because for non-compliance or non-cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And she appealed, but, immediately she couldn't afford her medications anymore, and she won her appeal the day after she died.
Yes. And there are several cases like that in this book, the Indiana case study anyway, where the computer, either by design or by incompetence, threw tens of thousands of people off Medicaid, off food stamps, whatever. And it's kind of hard for me to grasp that a large data company like IBM would create a database model, which they've been doing for many, many years, and have it completely blow up like this. So, I don't know. It happened. It happens, right? But and then we have the Indiana state culture, which is very anti-poor people, very kind of a libertarian kind of thing. You know, if you're poor, it's your fault. I'm not paying for your Medicaid. Get out. So was the algorithm designed to punish people and kick them off, or was there a combination of incompetence on IBM's part and the algorithm was designed kind of in a discriminatory manner? I don't know, but it's pretty sad. And so the governor who was in charge of the government at the time of setting up this project, he said that the whole welfare system in Indiana is an abomination. It's the worst in the whole United States. And we have to get people working and not on public benefits. Okay, well, that's what he accomplished. by throwing tens of thousands of people off their public benefits and not getting them jobs, not getting them job training, not, you know, throwing people off Medicaid and having them die. So in 2006, when they designed the program, when they were still, they were just turning it on, 38% of all poor Indiana families, and they didn't define what poor is, all 38% of those families were on some kind of benefits. By 2014, 8%.
Problem solved.
Yeah, so he reduced poverty by 30%. He's a genius. Of course, in 2007, 2008, 2009, the United States economy imploded. So how can we reduce poverty 30% over this time period when we have an economic collapse in the middle of it? I don't get it.
Well, I mean, he's not reducing poverty. He's reducing the amount that the state spends to combat the negative effects of poverty.
Right.
A point I think that you were touching on earlier, I just want to reiterate it, mm-hmm. is that when you write an algorithm to automate a decision process, you're not removing human judgment or prejudice from that process. Right. You're just automating it.
Yeah.
So that, like in 2016, Facebook was a conduit for a lot of genuinely fake news, mm-hmm. you know, which directed people to sites that were basically making money for people selling ads, you know, and the content was just, it was pandering to people's paranoid fantasies. It was pandering to the ugliest parts of human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook's defense was, hey, we're not curating this stuff. We're not spreading it deliberately. Yeah, maybe our algorithms, you know, serve this up to people, and, you know, it was a Facebook algorithm, but, you know, it wasn't anything we did intentionally. It's like, yeah, but who wrote that algorithm?
Right.
Who do they work for? They work for you.
Yeah.
Who do they make money for? They made money for you. So, you know, just saying it wasn't me, it was the algorithm. If you wrote the algorithm or you paid somebody to write the algorithm on your behalf, that's no defense whatsoever. And I don't think that that has been fully discredited in the public conversation yet, just because I think it goes one step or two steps deeper into, you know, the details than most people are willing to go.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of dangerous when we automate our social services, because those are human decisions and human needs, right? And they're not all just black and white, cookie cutter, you know, mm-hmm. it's not all by the numbers, not all of it, especially, I mean, Medicaid, yes, it's by the numbers to some extent, food stamps, yes, by the numbers, you know, but this, when you blow up a system and it kicks people off their health care and makes sure that they can't eat the next morning, that's a huge deal. That's really, and it took them so long to take responsibility for that. They had to sue IBM. IBM countersued. The state won $500 million from IBM. Then IBM countersued and won $50 million. And I don't think anybody's ever getting paid at all for this. That the judge who was overseeing the cases said, you guys should not be here. You guys should be fixing this system. Make it work for the people. You have damaged the culture and our state by this creating this monstrous system. So they've changed back to a more human to human kind of logic or if then statement, right? Mm-hmm. So now they have reinstated the local social services people. So you actually go talk to a human being again instead of calling a call center somewhere with a person who might even not be in Indiana, could be in India or something. So they've kind of moved back from the brink of complete disaster. But who knows where it'll go from there, because they still have this giant data warehouse, which you know, can be used for nefarious purposes, because they have tons of information about people's lives, detailed information about their lives, which, yeah. Anyway, Indiana.
I'm curious about the word police used as a verb in the title, automating inequality, high-tech tools, profile, police, and punish the poor. What do you remember about the policing aspect?
The case study about Los Angeles was the one that was directly had police involved. Yeah. So can we go to Los Angeles? Mm-hmm. Okay. So Los Angeles, these social services agencies got together and they said, okay, we don't know who's homeless, when they're homeless, what the circumstances of them being homeless are. Maybe you do because you met 50 people and you have their files. Maybe you do over here because you met 50 people and you have their files. But there's no centralized location to have all this information, right? So wouldn't it be better if we could manage this across all of our agencies by having this information available to all of us? Makes a lot of sense because you can't – I used to have a manager who said you can't manage a problem unless you can measure it. Mm-hmm. So that's what they were doing. They were measuring it, seeing who's where, why, when, what, right? And then try to take whatever available services are there and available to these people and have the computer make a decision who's going to get what, when, where. So it wasn't built for any nefarious purpose. It was actually built to provide services and more efficiently. And also so the politicians could know they knew the qualifications and the quantifications of the population they wanted to serve. And that makes it easier to raise money. Eventually, the mayor of Los Angeles was able to get a bond issue for more than $1 billion by using this data. Because all of a sudden, he had this to show other politicians and show the public, this is what the problem is. This is what we got. And this is what we don't have available to serve these people. So he got $1 billion for it. They're building like 20,000 housing units. So we'll see. But that's just happened. Like last year. So it's still nothing's done right with that. But anyway, so something like a dozen or two dozen agencies were collecting data on the homeless population. And the policing part is that, unfortunately, the Los Angeles Police Force was given access to the data without warrants so that they could pick up everything about you that all these different agencies has collected. And you've come in to the system, gone to a center, and you've actually taken a test and gotten a score in the system with an algorithm to see how vulnerable and needy you are. Your number depends on, you know, if you get an 18 instead of a 5, then you're more needy. So you get priority in the system. The algorithm says, okay, I got a housing unit available here. That person goes in there now. But the police are... So one of the problems with being homeless is that it's illegal to be homeless in a lot of places. And apparently in Los Angeles up until like 2012... the police routinely rousted homeless people, took away their belongings, destroyed their belongings, and wrote them tickets for sleeping on a street bench, sleeping on a park, right? So now if the police, so you got all these tickets and things that you haven't paid because you're homeless. You don't have $50 to pay the ticket for sleeping in the public park, right?
Right.
So you have an outstanding issue with the police. Now, maybe that's happened 20 times over 5 years, right? And all of a sudden, the courts want to start collecting money from people. We've got a database of all the people, where they are, who they are. We know the last time they were cited. And you go pick them up, and you bring them to prison, bring them to jail. And you put them in jail. And they can't pay the tickets, so they stay in jail. So this data warehouse is being used for fishing expeditions by the police and the court systems.
And then, having spent time in jail... that's now on their record.
Yes. And then when they try to enter the system.
Felons.
Yeah, now they try to enter the system again and get housing and stuff, and they can't.
Because they have a felony on their record. Yeah.
One homeless guy was interviewed here. He's college educated. He was a business executive, and he worked for one of those mortgage companies, subprime mortgage companies that went under, and he couldn't find a job after that. He's homeless. He's relatively stable. He's not addicted to drugs and alcohol. And he lives in a clean tent, and he's clean and everything, but he can't find housing. And because he gets through he entered the system, he gave them all his data, and they gave him a number, a score. Well, he's not mentally ill, he's not addicted, he's relatively stable person, so he's not needy compared to someone who is completely unstable, mentally ill, addicted. I get it, but this guy can't get into housing. One time they found him housing, an apartment that they would be subsidized, and the landlord wanted a stable 3 to 5 year rental history with credit references.
Right.
He's like, I've been living in a tent for 5 years. How can I give you that? It was impossible. They put him in an impossible situation. Just horrible. So he gets ticketed. So he, with his last money, he scrounged together $6,500 to buy a car. He figured at least he can live in that. And if he really gets down to where he can't even eat, he can sell the car. Well, he gets a ticket on the car for parking in a near a public park or something. I don't know. He says he didn't do it. He didn't do it. But he had to pay the ticket. He didn't have the money for the ticket. So they took his car away. And now he's getting fines after fines after fines. And his car is sitting in an impoundment lot. And there's no way he can ever pay for this car. So they've stolen his last asset just to add more misery to the guy's life.
You know, I told you about this COSA program that I've been involved with, and mm-hmm. the senior person in that here in Bellows Falls is a guy who used to be a probation officer, mm-hmm. and he's just of the opinion that the criminal justice system is really just, you know, a screw the poor system. It is it's an adversarial system where, you know, the targets are poor people, and This is a pattern so familiar. I mean, anybody who's involved in the courts or the criminal justice system will be able to put a name on this. It'll be different, you know, for each person listening. But it's a very common practice for somebody who is a prosecutor to have a career, you know, on the public dime, prosecuting criminals, and then to switch to defense, you know, go into private practice and be a defender of, in that exact same court. Mm-hmm. And so a person who, you know, suppose you ran the same person through the court system twice, exact same offense, exact same circumstances. First time that person has a public defender, the second time that person has a private attorney who is a former prosecutor in that same court, you reliably get two different outcomes. Mm-hmm. So the person who had that private attorney, who's a former prosecutor, the difference between him and the other guy is that he's got money, or he could come up with the money, or his dad's got money, or, you know, somebody, he could scrounge up the money somewhere to pay an attorney.
Right.
But the circumstances of his offense are irrelevant in that case. I mean, what's relevant is, did he come up with the money to pay the system to avoid punishment?
Yes. Sounds a little bit like extortion.
Yeah. And again, I'm talking about a particular person nearby. But I have lived in a lot of different places, and because, you know, my father was in law enforcement, I've known a lot of cops, I've known a lot of lawyers. I can attach different names to that role, you know, the private attorney who makes a lot of money defending people in the exact same courtroom where he used to be a prosecutor.
Kind of like a member of the U.S. cabinet going into lobbying after leaving the cabinet or leaving a high-level position in the administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and you know, in such situations where a defender or a private attorney is defending somebody in a court where he used to be a prosecutor, the police in that instance, you know, they just throw their hands up. It's like, okay, well, we can't win this one. So, you know, we know there's only so many people who can afford him, and he can only take so many cases. So, you know, there's a certain number of cases that it's just bad luck. You know, if you're a police officer and you're looking for a conviction, you don't want to go in and testify against somebody with that lawyer grilling you. He's going to make you look like an idiot.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's probably – there are going to be different rules in different municipalities. But in some places, the cops just won't bother. They just won't show up, you know, to give testimony. In those cases, why bother?
Yeah.
I mean, this guy is just going to make you look stupid, and you're going to lose anyway. So, you know, just give up on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing if you're the prosecutor. I mean, why throw your resources into that case when there's a handful of other people who are all being defended by the same public attorney, you know, the public defender,
right?
Who is overstressed and underpaid and, you know, has a too big a caseload to even know. Really, he's just sort of brokering plea deals. He's not actually defending anybody.
That is unfortunately the reality. Yep.
So.
Yep.
I've made my position pretty clear, haven't I?
Yes.
Back to automating inequality.
Yeah. Well, hopefully this data warehouse in LA is going to have some positive results. The $1.3 billion or whatever it is to build housing, that's a very positive thing. Very, very positive. The policing, the police fishing through the database should not be allowed. That's a privacy. I think it's a violation of the United States Federal Privacy Law, 1974. But they need housing. In 2017, the data warehouse estimated there were 58,000 homeless people in Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles.
What year?
2017, okay. Last year. And the system had scored, the people had taken the test, 31,000 of them. So they got to about a little more than half of the population. So they have actual real data on all these people. But they only have placed about 10,000 people in housing in 2017. So they got a need for 60,000 almost, and they could only get 10 in housing. So the 20,000 new housing units that they're building, that's going to make a difference, but they still need another 50,000 housing units. And that's not happening. There was another thing in here, that the Skid Row, you mentioned Skid Row. It predominantly, for a long, long time, it has been a place for down-and-out people, homeless people. But historically, there were lots of housing units there. But over time, those housing units have been destroyed or converted to something else. And as recently as just a couple decades ago, after an earthquake, the city changed its building codes and went to these Skid Row landlords and said, hey, you got to rebuild your building, or, you know, make it earthquake proof. And the guy's like, well, I got homeless people living here for $10 a night. How am I going to put $500,000 or $1 million into my building? So they tore them down. They tore down thousands and thousands of housing units after that. Not helpful. Not helpful. Then we move on to this Allegheny County. They have a child protective services program that they automated. They wanted to build an algorithm to determine who the kids were at the most risk of being abused in the home and would need to be placed in foster care or with their relatives or something. So they've created this big warehouse with an algorithm. And it's kind of like the LA thing in a way. It scores the kids. You get a score. So the data warehouse collects, let me see, I marked this page because I was so amazed at it. The data warehouse gets data on a regular basis from 29 different agencies and programs in that county, including adult probation, Bureau of Drugs and Alcohol Services, the Housing Authority, County Jail, juvenile probation, goes on and on and on. So they're collecting every bit of information about every family in Allegheny County and then scoring every family, scoring the kids and the families to see which the riskiest ones are. And then the algorithm says, oh, okay, we need to take your kids away today because the algorithm says this and says that. And there's no – and so the social services agents who used to make face-to-face decisions and go to visit the families and make sure of everything, they're now doubting their own decision-making because the algorithm tells them something different than what they think. And they don't want to – if the algorithm says the kid goes to foster care, but you with 30 years of experience say, no, I don't think the kids needs to go to the foster care, but you make a mistake and that kid gets killed or something.
Right.
Wow. You're dead. You're looking at lawsuits and all kinds of stuff. So they're letting it be automated and they're finding that, well, get this. So when they first created the data warehouse, a child protective services agency in New Zealand heard about it, and they came to town to take a look at it. And apparently the algorithm was relatively transparent. They were actually trying to help kids. And so the New Zealand agency took the data model back to New Zealand and back tested it and found that it was wrong 70% of the time. Yeah, not 10% or 20%, 70% of the time.
Worse than a coin toss.
Yeah, so they loaded data.
Much worse.
They loaded historical data and then looked for outcomes over time of the kids who mm-hmm. who went to jail, who got killed or whatever, or became a drug addict or a prostitute. And they looked at the data manually to see what those outcomes were. And then they ran it through the data warehouse and came up with 70% difference. Wait, I shouldn't be laughing. It's a horrible situation.
So well, I think we understand the nature of the laugh there.
Yeah.
It's gallows humor laughter.
Yeah. I mean, there's story after story in this case where children are being taken away, and then other children, the scoring is all weird, and they are kept in a horrible, dangerous environment. There's just one – oh, and the thing is, okay, so once you're scored as a risk, of course, that data never goes away. So let's say you got a high score as a kid, but you weren't removed from your home and you were allowed to become an adult. And then you have a kid you're already at the high risk zone because of your score as a kid and your family. So you've already got the system watching you, and you're a new mom or new dad, and you got two strikes against you already. So if somebody calls the Child Protective Services on you for any reason whatsoever, whether it's valid or not, you're screwed. You're already in that system with some check marks against you. And the data that's collected is not only your immediate family, it's your extended relatives as well. So if you have a child rapist who's your third, fourth cousin removed or something who lives somewhere else, that's a check mark against you. Anything, it's just crazy. They're making these really important decisions while they're not making them, and the computer do it for them. And they're coming out with some really terrible things.
You know, it seems to me that if the goal of a society and the actual intention of a system is to improve outcomes for people, that the more data that system has access to, the better. But if the operational assumption isn't improve outcomes, but score points against an adversary, and the adversary is poor people, then, you know, we'd really want to restrict the amount of data that system has access to in order to keep it from, you know, completely running roughshod over the poor.
Yeah.
But in that case, I mean, if we're to the point where this system is too efficient at what it does that we need to restrict its access to data, that should be a clue to us that really we don't need to restrict its access to data. We need to burn the damn thing to the ground. Yeah. And send all of the people who are employed in it off to places where they can make a living without hurting people, mm-hmm. and create a completely different system.
Yeah.
But there is no possibility of doing that.
Yes. And even when they know they have invalid data in this model, they won't expunge the data.
Right.
It's the problem. There's a story of one family. I think it's a single mom with a girl, a young girl, 9 years old. Well, for some reason, one of her neighbors is calling Child Protective Services as a harassment tool and saying, oh, I saw the kid walking alone down the street, or I saw the kid, you know, malnourished or whatever. And the Child Protective Services, they show up to inspect the home like they have always, right? Mm-hmm. And they, every single time one of these calls is made, it's been inconclusive. They've closed the investigation. But it's still in the database.
There's a record of it, yeah.
It's still in the database. So she can't even go to court probably and get it taken off that thing. So she's anyway. And they won't tell her who's making the calls. So that person's protected.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I heard an interview with the author, and she was mentioning that in one case she was looking at, you know, one Child Protective Services system, if there were two complaints against a particular household, you know, the system was required to take action. But she said that black or mixed race families had complaints, you know, phoned in against them twice as often as white families. So, you know, while the algorithm itself isn't prejudiced, prejudice has been encoded into the system. You know, that a prejudiced neighbor who keeps a sharper eye on their black neighbors than they would their white neighbors, and, you know, reports them to the state more often, that neighbor's prejudice is a factor in the decision-making process, which has been automated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because it's been automated, it can't be examined.
Right. Yes. And because people don't want to question it in the beginning. You know, I used to work in trading, and we used to use heavy math, big algorithms. Like the big banks, they have guys named quants.
Right.
Quantitative analysts, quantitative engineers, quantitative physicists. Mm-hmm. And they build these monstrous, monstrous algorithms. I mean, huge, with huge amounts of data coming in, like global data, right? Now, they back test to see if there's a problem with the algorithm.
Because there's money on the line.
That's the thing, yeah. Because the banks can lose billions of dollars if that algorithm is junk. So but that's not happening in this case. They pay $1.3 billion for an algorithm, and they don't backtest it. Makes no sense to me. Oh, yeah. You didn't want to have a bad algorithm in the banking industry. You could bankrupt the thing. But that happened, actually. It took down Wall Street. It was a big trading company called Long Term Capital Management, mm-hmm. and they built their algorithm based upon mean deviation. So, you know, statistical, I don't know if you've probably taken statistics at some point, but the statistical theory is that we all, all data points usually come to a middle, a mean, right? It's the bell curve, and most of the data is in the underneath that big top of the curve there, right?
Right.
So these guys said, well, this is a no-brainer. We're going to always trade within this mean area, and we historically expected deviations of a certain standard deviation away from the mean. So we have that plugged into our algorithm. Well, the algorithm wasn't safeguarded so that when the, say they went beyond two standard deviations on one side or the other. Well, if it's going to the left, it's negative territory. The algorithm should shut down the trading and say, okay, we're done for today. We lost some money, but we didn't go to four standard deviations where we would bankrupt the business. They didn't put the safeguards in. So it went for six standard deviations or way or more. I don't know the details anymore, and took down the whole company. So that's just financial. But this is, they're taking kids away from families when they don't backtest the algorithm.
Right. But no banks go bankrupt, so.
Nah, just get a bailout. Just get a bailout. Well, she makes some good points here at the end.
Does she have any prescriptions?
Well, she wants to get rid of this, what she calls the digital poorhouse, which is basically these algorithms forcing more problems on people who already have problems and creating just a lifelong poorhouse environment for them. Basically, she doesn't, her conclusion is not talking a lot about the algorithms. It's just like, well, get rid of them and just go back to a reality kind of based social services system in our country and stop treating the poor as if they're somehow dishonest, lazy people just sucking off the system, because maybe there are a few, but not most. Most are just having some bad luck. And in this country, when you have the bad luck, it could be disastrous. I mean, get into a car accident, you don't have health insurance, you're done. You're homeless. You got nothing. So she's saying we need to build, you know, healthcare systems, social services systems that have been envisioned and been proposed for 50 years now, but we still can't seem to get any legislation around them that's workable and effective. She talks about things going all the way back to Martin Luther King pushing his social agenda, and then the war on poverty programs in the late 60s, early 70s, which didn't really do much for anybody. I shouldn't say it that harshly, but she's talking about Canada, she's talking about Northern Europe, and maybe we should stop seeing those systems as socialism or communism and start seeing them as what they are, social services that work.
Yeah, whenever you throw a label at something like that, like, oh, that's communism, or that's socialism, or that's, you know, whatever, you're basically just, you're giving your reason for why you're not going to look any more closely, and you're certainly not going to look at outcomes. Hmm. You know, yeah. You're going to make a principled stand for your bad outcomes in the system that provides them. You know, I talked to a fair number of libertarians at this political convention, because a lot of people who are into politics and who are thoughtful about it, mm-hmm. they gravitate to libertarianism much, much more so than just in the population in general, who don't think a whole lot about politics, you know, who are just who gravitate to the system that's, you know, to the party that seems to represent their interests, you know, mm-hmm. their class interests, their social right. interests. But people who actually think about it, you know, a much higher percentage than in the general population gravitate to libertarianism. So it's very strange. I was just going out and striking up conversations with people at random. I wasn't looking for libertarians. And then, you know, the people who were well-spoken, I would invite them back to our booth where we would record an interview.
Oh, wow.
And it was back at, you know, on the microphone that I discovered that three out of the first five people that I had, you know, brought back just because they were well-spoken on the topic of politics were libertarians. And I didn't end up talking to anybody who was just a straight-up partisan Democrat. You know, I did talk to some Democrats, but they were the ones with nuanced positions. Mm-hmm. But you know, those were attendees or vendors or, you know, people manning booths at this convention. The people up on stage were the ones embodying just the most accusatory and angry, straight-up, across-the-board Democratic interest. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was feeling kind of put out because, you know, given that I was there recording interviews and handing out these postcards for the comic strip and basically just being on hand to represent the group that I was with, I didn't get to go to any of the presentations, you know, any of the formal events. And I made a point of going to one because it was about comedy. You know, it's a topic of interest to me. And it was just gross. It was really, really ugly. I mean, it was...
How so?
There were five comics. One of them was a Trump supporter. Three of them were Trump haters. And one of them was, you know, somebody who was interested in having some conversation. And it was just, you know, the Trump supporter would say something in defense of the president. Then the three Trump haters would talk over themselves, just spewing venom at this guy. And, you know, I hate to say it, but virtue signaling, showing that they are, as you know, they're the most woke at the table. And the one person who was not doing that was really ineffectual. I mean, trying to introduce some nuance into the conversation. And I went there to listen to, you know, a conversation about comedy in this environment, you know, where there's such polarization. And really all I got was just a demonstration of the polarization.
Right.
It was not edifying, to say the least.
Wow.
And I am not the kind of person to shout out of turn from the audience.
Right.
And I did in this instance.
Was there no moderator to like?
There was a completely ineffectual moderator who, as far as I could tell, was, you know, just on board with the anti-Trump people and who was happy to have them just dogpile on the one guy who was... He wasn't anybody whose opinion I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his defenses of Trump were, you know, right out of the playbook, just straight. There was no thought to them at all. I was not interested in this guy. But he was the one person at the table who was smiling and not hurling insults. Actually, there were two people. Two people smiling and not hurling insults, and he was one of them. And the other one was the person who tried to introduce nuance into the conversation and was roundly ignored by everybody else.
Mm-hmm. That's the state of the discussion.
That's the state of the public discussion. These were the personalities, the VIPs who came down from upstairs in order to speak in front of groups of people. But the people who were actually down, you know, on the convention floor, they had more nuanced positions and they were less drawn to finding the political differences with somebody so that they can argue about them. They were much more interested in just making connections with people. And again, it's because a lot of them were vendors of some kind or another. You know, they're there to connect with people, not to have a public combat with the other side.
Well, when you're a vendor, you don't want to necessarily attack people and piss them off.
Right.
Because their wallet goes back in their pocket.
And, you know, some of these people weren't selling products. They were selling ideas.
Sure.
But again, when you're face-to-face talking to people and you want them to listen to you and there's no audience, you behave much differently than you do when you are the representative of a viewpoint and you have the opportunity to attack a representative of a different viewpoint in front of an audience. That brings out a different sort of behavior. And it's in this instance, it was not helpful.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Well, any other thoughts on the topic of how an increasingly data-oriented system treats the poor?
Maybe we don't need to be using data-driven systems so much. and we need to backtest, and we need to make sure that if we're going to use these things, that there's not implicit discrimination in them. And we certainly shouldn't be allowing police departments to enter that data without a warrant.
If you were explaining backtesting to somebody who understood what an algorithm was but didn't really understand, who had no background whatsoever in, say, algorithmic trading, and you were saying, look, we need to institute some backtesting on these public systems that are supposedly helping us serve the poor.
Right.
Somebody's backtesting. What do you mean? What is that?
Well, you compare objective reality and physical results with what the algorithm said the results should be.
Mm-hmm.
And or you can use another algorithm to test for another algorithm. They do that too. It's quicker. So you just load data into a warehouse and just go at it. Go at it and see what the results are versus reality. And It's not so easy with a social services system, with a trading system where you have dollars and cents reality, right? The algorithm says we were going to make $1 billion. We lost $8 billion. Okay, that's reality, objective reality, right? With social services is a lot more squishy, I guess. It's not taking a kid away from their parents should not be completely data driven, because that's not a dollar loss or a dollar gain, or, you know, on a trade. It means a whole lot of different things. That's a kid's life you're impacting for the rest of their life.
Right.
Kids get taken away from their families and thrown into foster homes. Don't always have a good outcome.
Yeah, even if the parents are clearly deficient in some way, just taking the kid away from their actual parents is traumatic.
Oh, yeah. So we need to backtest the algorithm, but keep humans involved on a face-to-face basis with people.
Humans are slow and expensive, though.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. An algorithm can crunch a lot more data.
Yeah, but for the
much more cheaply.
But the $1.3 billion they spent on this algorithm, that's a lot of payroll.
Yeah. These are not bargain basement algorithms.
No. But they got ripped off. Nobody should be paying $1.3 billion for an algorithm. You can get some kids out of graduate school to build them for you for hundreds of thousands and thought. A billion or a few million, you know, for a bigger one. Yeah. No, those are my thoughts. I think we should send all of our politicians to some other countries for a year where they have working social services systems, where they have actual working healthcare systems for the vast majority or all the populations, right? We should be sending these guys to go see for real. I watched a Senate hearing. Just a snippet. One of our senators, I forget which one, was interviewing a Canadian doctor. Mm-hmm. The Senate was grilling this Canadian doctor and some other people from other countries, and they were coming to speak with the senators about their healthcare system. And there was one senator who went after this Canadian doctor relentlessly, asking her over and over how many people are dying every day on waiting lists because they can't get the surgery they need, or they can't get they have to wait for this. And she says, "I've never heard of that."
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of that happening. And then he says, well, so why is it that hundreds of thousands or millions of Canadians are coming to the United States for their health care? Because the health care system in Canada doesn't work. She says, I've never heard of that. Maybe they come to the States for elective surgeries, like breast implants or something, but for like a medically necessary surgery, they're not going anywhere. So these guys don't know this stuff, and they've isolated themselves from the reality. They won't do any study into it because it causes too much cognitive diffusion in their brains. But they're being completely dishonest about the way they're looking at it. So we have a huge world out there where they are working systems in various countries, and we should be taking some of the best of those systems instead of pigeonholing people with data. That's my two cents.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, that was Rob talking about the book, Automating Inequality. I don't have it at hand, so I can't rattle off the full title. But it occurs to me in revisiting that conversation with Rob that the rise of the algorithm, which is to say the rise of the information economy, the attention economy, and most importantly, the information technology economy, has given rise to a new wealthy class, and that wealth, you know, I hate to be zero-sum about it, but that wealth seems to have come at the price of swelling the ranks of the poor. And not the third world poor, but the poor in industrialized society. I know that I am not alone in being somebody who was raised middle class and who now, in terms of material circumstances, is poor. Poor by the standards of the middle class. I mean, I have my own apartment. I never go hungry. I don't worry about keeping the heat on. I basically just worry about, maintaining my obligations and wasting my life, basically just scrambling to keep the bills paid when I'm 50 years old and still in good health and in good physical condition. But, you know, I can tell which way the arrow is pointing. But back to the topic at hand, the more poor people there are, the more the criminal justice system has to grow. And it can't grow. I mean, if it were to grow to keep pace with the growth of the class of people that it is expected to control, it would have to hire a lot more people. So much of the growth of its reach into society will have to be automated. And algorithms encode prejudice, but algorithms also get built on top of previous algorithms. And while we can revisit, in fact, I think culturally we are sort of obsessed right now with revisiting and scrutinizing our psychological prejudices, the ones that are encoded into algorithms are not so easily pinpointed and do not respond to criticism or shaming. They only respond to being rewritten. Among the most disturbing things that Rob mentioned in recounting the book was the idea that people working in child protective services would defer to the judgment of an algorithm and privilege it over their own judgment because of what would happen if they followed their own judgment and then were proved wrong. If a child died or was clearly abused or neglected because they said that the child could stay with the parent when some algorithmic red flag had been raised. Given the consequences for being wrong in that instance, conscious, deliberate, professional, trained human beings have a strong self-preservation-oriented motivation to give up their autonomy and to defer to the judgment of completely unconscious, non-living algorithms. I think we're going to see a lot more of that going forward. At least, I hope we will, because if we don't see it, it's not because it isn't happening. It's just because we don't know how to look for it. All right. Well, this is going to be a short episode of the podcast. I actually recorded a fairly ranty, about 20 minutes, in response to the conversation with Rob, which I then promptly deleted because it went places that I'm not really ready to defend right now. We'll call that a first draft that I then ripped out of the notebook and threw into the fire. It's not completely gone because, you know, the thoughts came out of my brain and my brain is still here and will continue to articulate thoughts going forward. But I'm going to defer not to an algorithm, but to my own judgment about saying things which are maybe beyond what I'm really looking to stand behind or stake my reputation to, even among a small group of people like the C-Realm Vault subscribers. As always, thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you for taking an interest and following me as I investigate the topics that are of interest to me. I'm happy that they are of interest to you as well. All right, I'm out. I will talk to you again quite soon, really. I've already got the material recorded. The meat for the sandwich is already, what should I say, in the fridge. I will serve it to you quite soon. Stay well.